This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 1st, 2007. If you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Wednesday, August 1st, 2007. I'd like to note for the record, Commissioner Weintraub was unable to attend today, and Commissioner Walther is present by speakerphone from Nevada. And so we do have a quorum present, although there are only three of us at the table today. The first item on our agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2007-10. And we have a, my staff indicates I need to ascertain for the record. Commissioner Walther, you are present?
Yes, I'm present, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. You are coming through loud and clear, and the staff is very appreciative to know that that problem has been resolved. We have Stacy Shin and Richard Ewell from the General Counsel's Office here to present on the advisory opinion involving the Reyes Committee. I'm sorry.
Too late.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Vice Chairman has advised me we have two late submitted documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider alternative drafts of the subject AO that are set out in agenda documents 0754 and 0754A.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those aye. Opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-0. Ms. Shin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you respond to a request on behalf of the Reyes Committee. The Reyes Committee is the principal campaign committee of Representative Sylvester Reyes. It plans to host a golf tournament fundraiser where individuals or political action committees can sponsor each of the 18 holes. It plans to recognize each sponsor with a sign at the corresponding hole. In the case of individual sponsors, the sign would include the individual's name, title, and the name or logo of the individual's corporate employer. The Reyes Committee asks whether it may recognize the corporate employers of individual contributors at its golf tournament fundraiser as proposed. Agenda document number 07-54 concludes that the Reyes Committee may recognize the corporate employers of individual contributors, provided that the identification does not include the corporate employer's logo. Agenda document number 07-54A concludes that the Act and Commission regulations would prohibit the Reyes Committee from recognizing the corporate employers as proposed. We have received one comment on the alternative draft advisory opinions, and we'd be happy to address questions concerning the comment. Thank you.
Very good. Discussion? I guess I'll begin because I think I'm responsible for draft A. I think this goes to prove that reasonable minds can disagree. And this is my approach to this, and I think the approach that underlay trying to distinguish the use of the allowing individuals who made contributions to use the corporation's name and their title at the corporation, and distinguishing that from the use of the corporate logo, really turned on a notion of what the property of the corporation that was being used to facilitate the contributions was. And as I thought about it, my sense was that there was no doubt that the logo of the corporation was part of the property of the corporation, much as the way that the room space or telephones or employees of the corporation would be corporate resources which could not be used to facilitate contributions to federal candidates. And yet the name of the company and people's title in the company struck me as distinguishable because it seems to me that those are things that individuals who are not acting with the authority of the corporation can use, and that while the corporation can protect its logo and trademarked name in court, it cannot equally protect simply the use of its name, so long as the particular font face that the corporation is trademarked or its logo is not used. And that's why it struck me that these things were distinguishable. And I had put forward a proposed resolution of this that drew that distinction. Other thoughts, comments? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the distinction the chairman makes. I don't find it dispositive in this case. And let me start with where I started looking at this, and that is with what someone at the fundraiser sees. And let me note that I am not a big fan of the appearance standard, but I note that repeatedly in the judicial holdings validating the substantial portions of the act, that the court has said that both corruption and the appearance of corruption is something that the act is intended and constitutionally may be used to protect against. And one of the disturbing things about this to me is that anyone seeing this who should innocently wander onto the golf course on this particular day would certainly conclude that the corporation was somehow involved in this activity. And what bothers me particularly about that is that I don't see how we could distinguish between this situation where the communication is limited to the fundraiser, and so it's only people who've already given money and so on who show up and are there, but, for instance, to a fundraising invitation, whereas we know it's common for corporate lobbyists to be on the host committees of fundraisers for members of Congress and to have their names listed there. And I don't see how we could approve this request and yet say that the fundraising invitation that went out to 1,000 or 10,000 or 20,000 people couldn't have the names of the corporate lobbyists along with their employers or clients. And yet I think we would all say, well, this is getting into a real problem or a real issue here about whether the solicitation is being made by the employee or by the corporation. And so my conclusion is that when the corporate employee gives permission for their corporate affiliation to be used in a non-corporate context, that they're acting as an agent of the corporation, and that communicates the corporation's approval of that, and thus whether it's simply the name or the trademark really makes no difference. And the issue to me isn't so much one of trademark law as one of agency law. Where someone signing a letter, a senior employee, officer, agent of the corporation signing a letter with the corporation's name, normally the corporation is going to be responsible for that. And that's more or less what I see as going on here. I think I've said enough at this point, but that's the basis of my conclusion in supporting its actually draft A.
Okay. Other thoughts? Commissioner Von Spakovsky, are you seeking recognition? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I support the draft that you put together. You and I discussed this, and I have to disagree with my colleague, the Vice Chairman, on this. I think we're conflating two completely different and discernible issues. Obviously, an individual can't send out a fundraising letter on corporate letterhead. That clearly violates the law. But that's not the situation here. When a contributor, somebody who happens to be an employee of a corporation, decides completely voluntarily to contribute to an event like this, to attend an event like this, the first thing they have to do, and we all know this is the way campaigns do this, when he shows up at the event and gives them his check, almost all campaigns now make them fill out a contributor card, one in which they list the information that we require by statute and regulation. They have to put down their name, the amount they're paying, their occupation, which is going to be their title, if they're a senior vice president of a corporation, for example, and the name of their employer. So they have to fill out a card like this. What happens with that information? Well, that information is put in the disclosure report of the campaign. It's sent to us, and that information goes up on our website and is available to the world so that anyone who wants to see who attended this event, what their occupation was, and who they worked for, that information is available. Yet, we're basically saying, well, you have to provide all of this information, but if you put up a sign saying that at a table or otherwise, well, you're violating the law. Okay? Well, our regulation says a corporation, neither a corporation or its agents may use the corporation's resources to facilitate the making of contributions to federal political committee. Well, in that situation, the corporation isn't facilitating anything. The situation is that their employee on their own is voluntarily participating in this, and they're providing legally required information. I see that as very different and very discernible from a situation where they would be soliciting funds on corporate letterhead, which obviously is prohibited, or the situation that you have discerned in your draft of using a corporate logo, because the corporation can't prevent somebody from, you know, legally saying who they work for. But on the other hand, the corporation is going to have to give permission for its logo to be used, because that is an intellectual property right. Companies protect that very jealously. And then you might actually get into corporate facilitation. And there, I think, you do have a potential problem. But just listing somebody's occupation and who they work for, which is legally required to be disclosed in any event, I do not see as a problem.
Okay. Commissioner Walther, do you have thoughts on this? You're at the disadvantage of not being in the room, as we all eyes turn towards your chair.
Well, we talked about that yesterday, and I think in the future, maybe those of us that are absent, there could be a poster in our seat there so we could have some comfort from what we look like. But I tend to support the draft, also supported by the vice chairman, for many and pretty much entirely the same reasons. I think that I would draw a distinction in the sense that while these the linking of the contributor and his or her employer and placing that on the internet is different significantly in the way it's being used. One is a legal requirement to put on the internet, and the other is to actually, in a sense, advertise that relationship at a time when money is being raised and solicited. And also, I think, you know, in terms of there's no real reason for having to add that name at an event like this unless it's for the reason of giving the appearance of support or endorsement by the leader of the entity. And that I do think carries a weight that puts it in a far different light than if it's just a reporting obligation that is placed on the internet where there's no claim of any kind of solicitation of any kind at that point, and it can't really be drawn. But if you put the relationship and link it at a fundraising event, I do think that's different. Drawing on the chairman's distinction between the name and the logo, I understand the point, and I do share that distinction. But here, I don't think it makes a particular difference. Certainly, the name of a corporation is important, and people spend hundreds of millions of dollars to improve that name for a variety of reasons, whether it's for respectability, for quality of its products, the quality of its service, and to bring in favor with the public. And I think that becomes a special asset on its own, used in that context. And with the CFO or CEO's approval. So I don't see a distinction that makes a difference in connection with analyzing this issue. So I support the draft of the vice chairman.
I think Commissioner Walther makes a very important point that Commissioner Mason has been kind enough not to highlight in responding to my initial thoughts, which is that my position is made somewhat more difficult in this particular case because the committee makes clear that the purpose of wanting to include the corporate names is to facilitate contributions, and so they have laid out with a certain degree of clarity that as near as I can tell, is the sole reason for wanting to do that in this particular case. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, if we've all had our say on this, it looks like we have. I'm going to move to approve the alternative draft, which you put together, which is agenda document number 07-54.
Okay. Commissioner Von Spakovsky has moved adoption of agenda document 07-54. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No. Nay.
Okay. Madam Secretary, if you can record, the Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion has failed by a vote of 2-2. Commissioner, Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand there's some hope of persuading the chairman in reaching a resolution of this to support, perhaps with revisions, the draft that I have presented, and I understand that our completely absent colleague also may be willing to support it, albeit with some revisions, and so to further the business of the commission, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get a motion to instruct the staff to support a revised version of or to circulate for tally approval a revised version of draft 0754A.
Okay. Yes, Commissioner Weintraub has shared with all of us individually her support for something which is very similar to the vice chairman's version, and my understanding is that would take that to three votes. To my mind, it is not an ideal outcome, but is a reasonable one. In the end, I think, depending a little bit on the text, it's likely that I would be willing to support such a thing, and that would provide an answer to the requesters in this particular case.
I would so move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The vice chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I'm sorry, Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I just want to be clear, I understand the motion. The motion is not to approve the alternative draft. It is simply to send it back to OGC to make revisions, and then it will come around on a tally vote, correct?
That is correct. This is a practice the commission has used a number of times in the past, and so it would simply permit us to receive a revised version by tally and vote on by tally. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-0, and the staff is so instructed. Thank you. The next item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-11 involving the California Republican and the California Democratic Party. We have Margaret Pearl and Ron Catwan. Mr. Catwan's on. Johnny Levin is here in Mr. Catwan's absence. Counsel, proceed at your leisure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 0753 is a draft opinion in response to a joint request from the California State Democratic and Republican parties. The request asks about the application of the Act and Commission regulations to various communications sent before a state party fundraiser event where a federal candidate or office holder is included as a featured guest or speaker. The request includes three types of draft communications, which are described in the draft opinion. The draft opinion applies the Commission's regulations at 11 CFR 300.64 governing federal candidate and office holder appearances at state party fundraising events, and at section 300.62 governing the solicitation by federal candidates and office holders in connection with a non-federal election. Under these regulations, pre-event solicitations featuring a federal candidate or officeholder where that person has approved, authorized, or agreed or consented to be named in the solicitation must be expressly limited to funds that comply with the amount limitations and source prohibitions of the Act. The draft opinion concludes that two types of proposed communications are not permissible under the Act, but that the third type of proposed communication is permissible. We have received five comments on the draft advisory opinion and would be happy to discuss those if needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comments? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I cannot support the draft that's been put together by the Office of General Counsel because I think it goes against a specific exemption that Congress put into the statute, and I also think it goes against one of our specific regulations. There's no question that Congress, when it passed BCRA, said that, and this is in Section 441 IE, that a federal candidate can't solicit, receive, direct transfer, or otherwise raise funds in connection with a non-federal election unless the amounts are in compliance with state law and are not violative of the federal limits on both amount and sources. However, they then put in a specific exemption, and this is 441 IE3, in which they specifically said that notwithstanding this prohibition, a candidate, and here I quote, a candidate or an individual holding federal office may attend, speak, or be a featured guest at a fundraising event for a state, district, or local committee of a political party. Now, we then issued a regulation that basically repeated this particular provision, but then we added, and this is our regulation 300.64, state, district, or local committees of a political party may advertise, announce, or otherwise publicize that a federal candidate or individual holding federal office will attend, speak, or be a featured guest at a fundraising event, including but not limited to publicizing such appearance in pre-event invitation materials and in other party committee communications, and candidates and individuals holding federal office may speak at such events without restriction or regulation. Now, the problem with this opinion by this draft advisory opinion is it basically ignores that regulation. The approach in this draft AO does not recognize a means of advertising a federal candidate's appearance in pre-event publicity in which only the host is soliciting funds. As a result, the commission would hold federal candidates responsible for what is obviously someone else's solicitation. It would place organizers of non-federal fundraising events in the rather odd position of choosing between publicizing on their invitation who the featured speaker will be and telling potential attendees the cost of the event. State and local parties thus can invite a federal candidate or office holder to speak at a fundraising event as Congress clearly provided, but are prohibited from telling potential attendees who the speaker will be. Both of those pieces of information are factual matters, and the AO would reduce the total amount of information the public receives. If a federal candidate is simply a guest or a featured speaker, if he's not a host, he's not a member of the host committee, and he is not himself soliciting funds that are beyond the federally permissible limits, the mere inclusion of his name as a guest on the invitation is not a violation of the law. And I expressly reject the illogical system of rules set out in this AO. When it comes to solicitations, a federal candidate should only be judged according to his own words and actions, and yet this AO comes to the inconsistent conclusion that a federal candidate will not be judged according to his own words and actions in the case of someone else's specific solicitation of funds, but instead will have the solicitation imputed to him. However, the AO then concludes in its answer to question three that there won't be any violation of the law if the state or local party sends out two notices about the same event in separate envelopes instead of just one. The first notice is an announcement stating only that a certain federal candidate or office holder, but not identified, is going to be the featured speaker at an upcoming event. That's not a problem under this AO because it's just pre-event publicity. But then they have to send a second notice containing no mention. The first one can have the name of the federal candidate, but then the second notice can't mention the federal candidate where they say how much it's going to cost. Basically, what we're saying is that by a local party simply doubling the cost of its postage, it can get around this rule, which is obviously promoting a rule over any kind of substance in this matter. I mean, that just sets up to me a bureaucratic labyrinth of rules with no purpose. You know, two of the commentators on this rightfully noted, quote, "No member of Congress who voted for this bill would ever have conceived that his or her state party would have to send two separate sets of invitations to the same list, one noting the federal office holder's attendance and a second, separate invitation telling the invitee how much it costs to attend and affording an opportunity to respond." And I seriously doubt that Congress would have ever thought that after it specifically provided that federal candidates and office holders could appear as guests or speakers at local party events, the commission would then implement a rule saying, well, the party can't include the guest or speaker's name in the notice of the event if the party charges a fee for attending the event that is perfectly legal under state law. What's even stranger about this outcome is that a federal office holder who attends such an event as a featured speaker and makes a speech discussing important public policy issues with absolutely no oral solicitation of any kind in his speech will still be found to have violated this law because the party committee hosting the event, the party committee sending out the invitation, noted in its invitation that that particular office holder would appear and speak at the event. And I just think this is an illogical way to approach it, and I also think it goes against the specific exemption that Congress put into the law.
Thank you. Other thoughts? I guess I can share. Vice Chairman, can I? I think I'll share mine first. I think the problem is more subtle than Commissioner von Spakovsky portrays, and I think it is a problem that grows out of the statute, and I think a fair effort on the part of the staff and to draw from both the statute and the regulations what the appropriate line is, and I think that line is correctly found in the draft, and that's why I support it. But let me take a step back. I mean, this all grows out of a prohibition adopted in BCRA on federal candidates soliciting money outside of the federal system, specifically outside of from sources that are prohibited from giving contributions under federal law and from permitted sources in some excess of those permitted by federal law. And this was one of the cornerstones of BCRA. And in passing that prohibition, Congress created some very specific exemptions. One exemption, for example, allowed federal office holders or candidates that were running for state office to solicit, to receive, and spend money that was permissible under state law for their own state campaigns, even if from sources that were not permitted to give money under federal law or in sums excess of what was permitted for under federal law. Another exemption, which is the one that we're wrestling with today, allowed federal office holders and federal candidates to attend, to speak at, and be featured guests at state party fundraising events. And the question for me, and I think the question presented here, is whether that exemption for attending at the events also allows the federal candidate to participate in the preparation of solicitation material. Because we, in our regulations, I think appropriately made clear that state parties could mention the anticipated attendance of federal candidates or office holders in their solicitation material. But here, what is sought is for the federal candidate to have some role in the preparation of that material, at a minimum its approval. My sense is, and the state, at least some of the commenters' sense is, and I think the great problem with this being that the federal candidates and office holders would like to have some control over what is said about them in this solicitation material. Also, I think some of the commenters desire for the federal office holders and candidates to have some control over the content of the solicitation material to make sure they complies with law, the law, and yet also not run afoul of the prohibition on them soliciting sums outside of our limits and controls. There are a variety of different alternative ways to get around this problem. Commissioner Von Spakovsky has mentioned some. The other is for the candidate simply not to be involved in the preparation of the solicitation material, the federal candidate not to be involved in the preparation of the state solicitation material. We have some comments that indicate that that is truly unworkable that candidates are unwilling and, or will be unwilling to do that. And it's possible that may be true. The problem for me is looking back at the statutory language. If the exemption that was crafted for the appearance at these events, the attendance speaking at or being featured guest, also included the freedom to solicit contributions for that event, which is, I think, what is being suggested here, then it would be drafted somewhat like the exemption that appears right before it in the statute, which does allow federal candidates to solicit state permissible funds, regardless of source or limits, for their own state races. I think the staff draft in this particular case grows out of the statutory language, grows out of our regulations, which say that the party can solicit these funds and can mention federal candidates in the solicitation of these funds, but draws a line to the degree that the federal candidate themselves becomes involved in the solicitation. Is the reason why, at the end of the day, I think that draft comes out with the right result. Other thoughts? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Commissioner Von Spakovsky's conclusion as to the particular application here, though with an important difference in the analysis. And let me first start with a general comment. The analysis in the staff draft, which I think is reasonable, I don't have a problem with that. And in fact, on first blush, I thought it was the right conclusion, and this was one where the comments were helpful to me in getting me to take a second look. And while I also don't agree with a lot of what's in the a lot of the specific arguments made in the comments, I do agree with the conclusion for reasons that I'll go through. But first, let me note that part of the problem here is that rather than starting with the statute, which is not perfectly clear, but is I think the place to start, and then moving to the regulations, which likewise are unfortunately not perfectly clear, but I think sufficiently clear for this purpose, and then to the ENJ. In essence, we're starting backwards from the ENJ, and we read the ENJ, and there's a whole lot of ambiguous language in the ENJ, and we conclude from that, and you know, start kind of working back through, and I think that is the wrong way to approach the question, to approach any analytical question under the Act. If we conclude that the statute, for instance, doesn't allow a particular activity, then I think we should not allow ourselves to follow logic in an ENJ and in advisory opinions and so on like that in kind of a common law fashion that runs against the text of the statute. I think we would all agree with that. And I think, likewise, we shouldn't follow that same logic and apply a kind of common law logic of advisory opinions and E&J text to prohibit something which the statute allows, and I think that's what's happening in this case. First, let me note the analytical difference that I have with Commissioner Von Spakovsky, and that is that I do view the candidate giving permission for his or her name to appear as featured guest on a fundraising invitation as a solicitation by the candidate, more or less for reasons outlined by the chairman, that I think any other result is impractical. We've had advisory opinion submissions that say, well, only the lawyer will know, you know, and that somehow makes it okay, or that we're only doing this to ensure compliance with the Act. And I agree that is a wholly impractical line for us to try to enforce, because then what? We would be having to intrude on the attorney-client privilege to determine whether or not the information had been divulged beyond the lawyer, or to look at the communications to see whether they were in fact talking about merely about compliance with the Act or about other things, about how it would look or graphics or who knows what else. And so I think in effect the candidate saying, yes, you may use my name in connection with the fundraiser, constitutes the candidate's participation in that solicitation sufficient to fall within the general ban in BCRA. However, what we're dealing with here is an exemption from that general ban. And while I acknowledge that the words of this particular exemption are different from the other exemption, the exemption allows a candidate to appear as a featured guest. And I cannot imagine, and this goes to the intent of Congress, that anyone who enacted that before our regulations, before our ENJs, before our advisory opinions, had any conception other than that what that meant was that the candidate's name could appear on the fundraising invitation, because that's what being a featured guest was. That's all it meant. And so I read the exemption as allowing a candidate to make that solicitation. Again, it's an exemption from the solicitation ban. It's not an exemption from some appearance ban or something of that nature. And one of the things that we did, and I think some of our critics didn't appreciate this, is we worked hard in the regulation in E&J to cabin that exemption to particular behavior. And one way we did that was at the fundraiser only. And people are kind of over-focused on that now. That's part B of our regulation. But the other way we did that is to say that doesn't mean you can do other solicitations for the state party. You can't sign direct mail appeals. You can't do other things like that. And that's what our ENJ was trying to communicate and get across. However, I do think that the statute and the regulation itself clearly say that a candidate can appear in as the featured guest in the fundraising invitation that includes prices and so on like that. To do otherwise, by the way, would be to read 300.64A out of the reg book. Why do I say that? Because we have said in other contexts that, in for instance, the Republican Governors Association advisory opinion, that if the organization goes through this two-step process, they send out the save-the-date card with the candidate's name on it, but no prices, and then a separate solicitation that includes a request for funds, that's not a solicitation by the candidate. And what we're now doing is saying that same two-step process has to be applied by the state party. So what that means is that the state district or local committees of political parties may advertise, et cetera, reading from 300.64A, and that has the same application in the case of a fundraiser that is prohibited by the statute as one that's protected by the statutory exemption. And I don't think we can read our own regulations that way. However, that doesn't mean that candidates can go out and ask for funds for the federal candidates can ask for funds for non-federal candidates under the same rules. Because, in other words, I think this is a solicitation, and so these other requirements would apply if we're talking about non-federal candidates. And it also wouldn't apply, or the exemption would not apply to solicitations for non-federal candidates simply because they were made in conjunction with or at the same time or at the same event as a solicitation for a state party committee. In other words, the state party committee fundraiser is limited to that and does not carry with it a broader right to make appeals for funds at joint fundraising events where there's an appeal also being made for state candidates.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther, would you like to speak on this matter or anybody else?
I support the position and generally the draft by the Office of General Counsel and the position as stated by the chairman. The to me, it's always hard to draw a line, and I think that's one of the hardest parts for a job is when we come up against reasonable arguments on both sides and have to take a position at some point that draws a line and may seem curvy or fuzzy, but a line does have to be drawn at some point. In this case, what draws me to agree to the OGC opinion is it's clearly the only role that a person can play as a candidate is to be a featured speaker at the event. It does not allow the candidate, or the federal office holder, to be in a position of soliciting prior to the event or for non-federal funds. And I think in this case, when we begin to head down that road by permitting a solicitation to contain the same card, a draw to come to obtain those kind of non-federal funds by the person, it gets us one more step down the line that I think is not good policy and really not consistent with our philosophy of the AOs or what the law should be. So I support the draft of OGC, and I recognize that we're deadlocked on this issue, but that's how I see it.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to make 2 points, and that is there was some discussion when you were talking about this about the candidate being involved in organizing the event, preparing the materials, et cetera. There's nothing in the AO request that indicates anything like that. But let me point out that the rule as laid out in this AO is such that if a federal candidate or a congressman or a senator simply receives a telephone call saying, we're having a local party event, we'd like you to be a speaker on such and such a date, will you be a speaker? And that is his only involvement. He has no involvement in preparing the invitation. He has no involvement of any kind in the mailing list, organizing the event. The only thing he does is say, yes, I'll be there on the date you want me to be there to speak. If the local party then puts his name as the featured speaker on their invitation, he has violated the law because he's soliciting events, even though he's had absolutely no involvement whatsoever, as you indicated, might be a problem, in looking at the materials, reviewing it, and preparing it. So what we're doing is we're imputing a solicitation to him, even though he had absolutely nothing to do with it. And to me, it completely abrogates the specific exemption that Congress put into the fundraising prohibition. I mean, that exemption even has a two-word title before it says fundraising events, and then it launches into the exemption. And I just find it very odd that we would say the congressman under such circumstances, when he's simply doing what Congress said he could do, be a guest, is violating the law.
I don't read the opinion that way, but Vice Chairman Mason.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to cut you off. If you want to say something further, I'm happy to listen.
Okay.
But in light of what we've said, if someone wants a vote on a version as it sits, that's fine, but to try to move our business along, I would propose that the Office of General Counsel be instructed to redraft the response to indicate that the commission concludes that proposed communication number 3 is acceptable for the reasons outlined in the draft, but that the commission could not come to agreement or render an opinion as to proposed communications numbers 1 and 2.
Okay.
And that be circulated for tally vote.
Okay, that seems like a reasonable step to take at this point. So the vice chairman has moved, so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, hearing none. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record that the vice chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-0, and the general counsel's office staff is so instructed. Thank you very much for your assistance in this matter. The next item on our agenda is a report of the Audit Division on the Ted Poe for Congress matter. We have Martin Favin, Joe Stoltz, and Terrence O'Brien from the Staff Director's Office from our Audit Division. A return appearance on this one. Gentlemen, welcome. Please proceed.
As you know, there were four recommendations in the final audit report, three of which the committee corrected by filing the appropriate amendments. And the third finding is on the documentation of receipts, which is the finding that the commission has been considering for a week or so about whether the bank having the checks maintained by the bank is acceptable for the record-keeping regulation. And we'll take any questions, Mr. Chairman, at this point.
Thank you. This is, and if others want to speak out first, otherwise I will proceed, this being my something that I'd spoken about a fair amount before. I appreciate everybody's indulgence, and I want to express a particular appreciation to the audit staff for the efforts they have made speaking with me and especially with my staff in the time since we last got here as we tried to sort this through. And I think that this has highlighted a whole range of sort of issues related to the use of sampling and the procedures that we use in auditing important and I think well worth further consideration and discussion by the commission. I think that this case probably presents a reasonably poor format to proceed in thinking through some of those issues and discussing those issues for a whole range of reasons. One is that regardless of how we come out, my sense is it doesn't have an effect on this particular matter. This particular finding is below our thresholds, and so no matter what conclusion we reached in all of this, it would not be proceeding to the Office of General Counsel for further action, and so there isn't anything particularly pressing about this. In addition, my understanding is that the sampling technique, the particular sampling technique that is that was used in this case, is either in the process of being phased out or has been phased out in future matters, and therefore, to a certain extent, it's addressing a procedure that is really, if not no longer in place, fast on its way to no longer being in place, and therefore is probably not as constructive for us to parse through how we want to handle matters under our forward-looking procedures as it would be to address those questions separately. And lastly, my sense is that the audit staff also believes that on this particular matter of the checks at the bank, that at the end of the day were we to provide the sample and list to the committee and the committee were to produce these documents, that they really don't believe that there is any reasonable likelihood of there being any sort of fundamental problems that underlie this particular matter in the committee's records, and therefore, to a certain extent, it would be not particularly useful as a use of their time to proceed and collect these particular sample records and cross-reference them. The record review they've done so far, I think my impression is, has left them with a reasonable degree of confidence that further or more significant problems will not be revealed by a more thorough examination of these particular records. So for all of those reasons, my suggestion is that at this matter we make a series of small amendments to the revised agenda document that Mr. Stoltz and his staff have forwarded to us. And my proposal would be in the summary to delete the last sentence, which says that absent the production of the records for inspection, the bank's maintenance of the contributor check copies does not comply with the regulations, and leave the wrestling of that issue to a later matter, and instead insert some text that we used in a number of the presidential audits when we reached matters that we couldn't reach a clear resolution on, and insert instead a text which reads, "The Commission voted to receive this finding without any determination on the merits of the analysis of the facts or interpretation of the law contained therein." This would allow us to bring this particular matter to a close, allow our audit staff to move on to other pending audits, and to allow the Commission to sort of think through how we want to address the issue of sampling and sampling failures in those areas where they will be more relevant to our ongoing work. So that was my thoughts, my suggestion, and I'd be happy to hear either from our auditors to the degree that I'm wrong on any of that, or from the other commissioners as to their thoughts about that as a method or path upon which to proceed. Mr. Stoltz.
I think that's a reasonable solution to this particular situation, and as you say, we can deal with larger issues in a non-case-specific context. Probably a better way to do it.
Okay. Commissioner Von Spakovsky?
Mr. Chairman, I approve of the language amendment you're making on this, but I want to ask a question, because I don't want to hold this up. We've already held this over, and we obviously want to get this done. But my question is this. Right before the change you want to make, where we delete the sentence that starts absent the production and add another one, you know, right before that has a sentence that reads, TPC also provided several contributor check copies it recently obtained from its bank as samples, comma, but did not provide the majority of the missing records. Now, if I understood correctly all of our prior discussions about this, the whole concern there was the fact that, yeah, they didn't produce the missing records, but I thought the problem was we did not tell them specifically which records we wanted them to produce. And if that's correct, then if we leave that last phrase in, but did not provide the majority of the missing records, when we didn't tell them what the records were they needed to produce, it gives the impression to anyone reading this audit that the committee didn't cooperate with us. Whereas I don't think that's the problem, if that's correct. The problem is we didn't exactly tell them which records we wanted. So if that assumption is correct, that that's in fact what happened, shouldn't we take out that last phrase about not providing the majority of the missing records? Now, that's my question.
Certainly. No, it's well put. My impression, and Mr. Stoltz can correct me, is that this was not a reference to the sampling error, but to the larger universe of records. But
it is a reference to the larger universe, and though we did not provide the specific sample items we were looking for, we did provide a list of missing deposits that the records were not available for.
And so my impression was that this particular turn of phrase wasn't linked to the sample that produced the particular checks that produced the 19% sample, but referred more broadly. That said, you know, so that was sort of my sense, but it may be that, but we could also proceed in a different way if you'd like.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, the problem with that is, I mean, the sentence before is talking about contributor checks. I mean, the first part of the sentence is talking about, we're saying here we didn't, the missing records we asked them for specifically were deposits, certain deposits. But what we're talking about there is contributor checks, so it gives the impression that it was the contributor checks copies that they didn't provide to us. But I thought those were the ones where we didn't specifically tell them which ones we wanted.
Well, the deposits were made up of contributions, or at least we're pretty sure they were made up of contributions. So they were deposits of contributor checks that were not among the records available at the time of the fieldwork.
We need every vote on this one today. So if you'd like to, Vice Chairman Mason.
Yeah, I agree with the chairman's disposition here, and there is a problem in the sense that if the Poe committee was relying on the bank to keep its records and an audit came out and drew a sample, then the Poe committee needed to produce those records, and they didn't do that. And interestingly, they didn't fail to do that apparently because they were unable. They failed to do it because it would have been very expensive to request all of the missing deposit items and have the bank go back and find those and produce them. And so in that sense, I'm not bothered by saying, hey, some of these records weren't here. The problem that I had was, well, then what? Because in this particular context, after going through the records that were there and the records that were produced and so on, I think we're satisfied that the committee could produce the records, and we're also satisfied that the risk, and that's what audits are all about, is not 100% check of everything, but the risk of material problems in that subset of missing records was very, very low. And so in this particular case, I don't think there's anything to be gained by requiring the committee to go to a very large expense of going back and producing 100% of the records. But as a factual matter, they didn't provide 100% of the missing records. And so that's, it didn't bother me to say that. But to go on and in essence say in this case, that's simply not a material violation. Because it doesn't appear to mask the absence of records or the wanton failure to keep them, nor does it tend to indicate a big risk that there's a violation, a substantive underlying violation that we can't find.
Okay. Further comments, Commissioner Walther? Any thoughts on this matter?
Yeah, I will support the. A recommendation of the chairman, but in this case, but I am concerned that we can't define for ourselves exactly to what degree we are requiring the sample of documents that we can't identify when we know we can locate them by getting on the computer and pulling them off the account. In other words, most of us, if you have a bank that makes a photocopy of your checks and that's all, and some banks, I have one bank that gives your statement back with a photocopy of the check but not the check, but the other one you can just go on and get it. And so I'm wondering, is the problem the fact that it's going to require the audit staff to get on the computer and search the database at the bank, but could do so remotely by a computer? You just get on the computer and you scroll through the transactions until you want one, and you press a button, you get a photocopy of it, and you can do that without giving advance notice to the candidate or the committee of which particular item you're looking for. But if you're saying, I'm more interested in the deposit of a certain date, for example, I don't know what indicia it is when you cull out certain documents that you want, whether it's by date or whatever, but you can identify that well enough so that you could, if you had access to the computer, whether at the committee or if they gave you the code word to get in and look at it, would that, Mr. Stoltz, not solve the problem? In other words, if they said, okay, Mr. Stoltz, you don't have all these things, but here's a computer and here's the password, I go ahead and scroll, and you press this button here, and you get a photocopy of it. Would that work?
Oh, that would work fine, and it more commonly, though, unless you have made some sort of an arrangement in advance, that works for checks that the committee issues. In most cases, it doesn't work as well for checks that an account holder has deposited. Those are usually a little more difficult to get. If it was as simple as scrolling through, that that would solve the problem. There are arrangements that can be made with banks. We've done a little scratching around in the weeks since this first came up, where you do have that kind of access. But it's something that needs to be set up in advance with your bank. And, in fact, there's one floating around where you actually make the deposits directly from your office in your computer, and you don't even have to go to the bank to drop them off. And then you have access to 2 years' worth of your deposited items over a secure Internet connection. That would be great. And then they can be, if you need them for longer than 2 years, you can download them, copy them to CDs, and store them. That's not the situation we had here.
Technology will ride to the rescue.
Yes.
It will get solved. All right, well, I will support the recommendation of the chairman in this case. I'd like to say whatever outcome of this debate is, it didn't affect the outcome of the audit and what we would do with it.
Okay. Thank you. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the final audit report with the revised finding 3 set forth in agenda document 0748A with as further revised as described by the chairman to delete the last sentence in the summary section and insert instead the commission voted to receive this finding without any determination on the merits of the analysis or the facts or the interpretation of the law contained therein.
Very good. The vice chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the vice chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-0. The last item on our agenda involves management and administrative matters. Ms. Clark, are there any such matters for us to discuss today?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, I bring to close the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for August 1st, 2007. Thank you.